Thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. To ask a question at that time, you will press star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have objections, you may disconnect at this time. I'd like to turn the meeting over to your first host today, Alicia Downs. You may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for today's COCA conference call entitled "Poison Control Centers and Toxicosurveillance: Real-Time National Surveillance for Outbreaks of Chemical-Associated Illness." We are very pleased to have Dr. Josh Shear present on this call. The PowerPoint we'll be using for this call was updated at 10:15 a.m. today. If you downloaded your slides before this, you may want to download the updated version now. Please go to www.emergency.cdc.gov/COCA, C-O-C-A. Click on Conference Call Information Summaries and Slide Sets. The PowerPoint can be found there. Dr. Shear is a medical toxicologist in the Health Studies Branch within the Division of Environmental Hazards and Health Effects in the National Center for Environmental Health here at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Shear serves as the primary medical toxicology subject matter expert for all of his branch's response and research activities. The objectives for today's call. After this activity, the participants will be able to understand the role of poison control centers in cases of clinical illness, understand the role of poison control centers for surveillance of chemical-associated illness, and understand the potential benefits as well as the limitations of using poison control centers in national surveillance for chemical-associated illness. In compliance with continuing education requirements, all presenters must disclose any financial or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters, as well as any use of unlabeled products or products under investigational use. CDC, our planners, and the presenters for the seminar do not have financial or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters. This presentation does not involve the unlabeled use of a product or product under investigational use. I will now turn the call over to Dr. Shear.
Thank you. Thank you for that introduction. Good afternoon, and it is a privilege to be able to talk to you today about poison control centers and their role in toxicosurveillance or real-time national surveillance for outbreaks of chemical-associated illness. This is a joint project between scientists at the CDC and the American Association of Poison Control Centers. I would also like to take a minute to acknowledge the large number of people working on this project, both at CDC and AAPCC, as well as at all of the local and regional poison centers who are among the people responsible for managing individual cases of illness, as well as entering data into this system. Next slide, please. Next slide again, please. There are about 61 poison control centers all over the United States that participate in the system that I will be describing. They can be further broadly classified into three categories: local, state, and multi-state. This classification basically describes their particular catchment area. Local poison control centers are responsible for calls in a defined region within a state, where state poison control centers typically cover an entire state. Some poison control centers, as we shall see, actually are responsible for covering more than one state. This being said, there is nothing to preclude individuals from anywhere in the world from calling a specific poison center if they want, and many local poison centers receive calls from all over the country and even the world. Next slide, please. In front of you, you should have a crude map demonstrating the location of all 61 poison control centers. As you can see, many states have more than one poison control center, and some have none. The states that do not have a poison control center typically route their calls to a neighboring poison control center as part of a pre-existing agreement between health authorities of the two states. Next slide. Poison control centers are staffed by specialists in poison information. These are typically health professionals such as nurses, pharmacists, and even physicians that undergo advanced clinical toxicology training. There is also a separate Specialist in Poison Information, or SPI, certification process. Each poison control center typically also has a managing director who is usually responsible for managing the spies and daily activities of the poison control center, and a medical director. A medical director is a physician, usually board certified in the subspecialty of medical toxicology, and who often has completed a formal fellowship in medical toxicology. The medical director provides medical backup for clinical issues as needed. There also may sometimes be overlap between some of the roles and responsibilities of these two individuals. Next slide, please. The American Association of Poison Control Centers has established a toll-free number that will connect the caller to the closest poison control center automatically by dialing 1-800-222-1222 if calling from within the United States. Poison control centers received more than 4.2 million calls in 2007. Of these, about 2.6 million were actual calls regarding human exposures, and 1.6 million were information-only calls. Information-only calls may be about a wide variety of issues, including drug interactions, teratogenicity, adverse drug reactions, poison prevention, weapons of mass destruction, or other issues. Although there is a poison, about 132,000 calls were also in regard to animals. Although there is a poison control hotline for animals staffed by veterinary specialists, this is a separate number and separate organization, there is a charge associated with the use of this service, so many people choose to call the existing poison control center network established for humans. Of note is that there were more than 4.2 million follow-up calls to confirm patient safety, provide additional information, and obtain outcome data for exposures in 2007 alone. Next slide. As you can see from the slide here, over the last 23 years or so, the number of populations served by poison control centers, as well as human exposures, has increased dramatically. In 1983, there were only 16 participating poison control centers that accounted for approximately 250,000 human exposures, whereas as of 2006, there are 61 poison control centers that now account for approximately 2.4 million human exposures. Now I would like to talk a little bit about the day-to-day role of spies, or specialists in poison information, in regards to data collection. I will take a minute to emphasize now that the primary responsibility of the spies is for providing clinical guidance and managing actual cases of illness. However, after this has been done, spies do enter much of the collected information into a local server. The type of information entered includes a variety of things, including basic demographic data, as well as clinical data. The spy is somewhat limited as to the type of data that can be collected and entered into the system, as there are limitations on the data in the system. For instance, there are 131 pre-coded clinical effects, or signs and symptoms, that the spy can choose from when it comes time to choose the clinical effects for the particular case. In addition, there are 72 pre-coded treatment, decontamination, and management options that the spy can code. Some of the examples of data that a spy can enter include things like patient age, substances involved, route of exposure, reason for the exposure, location of the event, signs and symptoms resulting from the exposure, and medical outcomes. In addition, there is a comment box where specialists in poison information can make comments and notes about the case and also include relevant details that may not have a pre-coded option available, such as including a descriptive narrative of the exposure scenario. This information is stored locally on the local server and not uploaded to the national database. I will talk more about this shortly. Data entered by the spy is stored on the local server and is uploaded in near real time to the National Poison Center database. This electronic database is managed by the American Association of Poison Control Centers. The database was formerly known as the Toxic Exposure Surveillance System, or TESS, but it has been rebuilt and renamed as the National Poisoning Data System, or NPDS. All 61 poison control centers contribute data to the national database in the manner which was just previously described. Additional details coded by size in the comment box are not included in the upload, and they are not available through the national database. Next slide. This is a schematic illustration of the data flow within the National Data Poisoning System, National Poisoning Data System. Queries to local poison control centers come from members of the general public and from health professionals. These are most commonly located in hospitals. Local poison control centers collect this information, provide clinical guidance and follow-up activities, and then enter data into their local server. Information is then uploaded in near real time to the National Poisoning Data System. So what exactly is NPDS and what does it do? Well, NPDS monitors and analyzes real-time data from individual poison control centers to detect intentional and unintentional chemical exposures and illnesses. Next slide. There are a number of different utilities for the National Poisoning Data System. It serves as a repository for case information from calls. It is the only comprehensive acute poisoning surveillance database in the U.S. It can help focus prevention education efforts and guide clinical research. Finally, it can also be used to identify trends, both in known types of exposures, but also in not previously documented types of exposures. Next slide. For instance, the recreational use of gamma-hydroxybutyric acid, or GHB, which causes transient coma-like symptoms, bradycardia, and apnea, came to light as the result of poison center-based observations. The reference is below for the audience in case they wish to learn more. What I have described thus far is mainly the structure, operations, and utility of the National Poisoning Data System as it has been used up until the last several years. I would now like to discuss more in depth how the National Poisoning Data System is being used for toxicosurveillance activities. In 2003, the charge came to CDC to create a National Chemical Terrorism Surveillance System. What resulted was a collaborative effort between the American Association of Poison Control Centers and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to use the National Poisoning Data System for this purpose, and hence toxicosurveillance was born. The primary goals of toxicosurveillance are as follows: to improve public health surveillance for chemical exposures, to identify early markers of chemical events, including characteristic symptom complexes, temporal and regional increases in hospitalizations, and sudden increases in case frequency or severity, with the objective of providing a rapid and appropriate public health response. A third goal is to track ongoing events. Next slide. The remarkable temporal consistency of data from the National Poisoning Data System allows detection of outliers and aberrations. These aberrations could represent chemical or bioterrorism incidents, but they could also represent other types of incidents of public health significance. Some examples include contaminated products, new drug or product hazards, and emerging drugs of abuse. Next slide. Here we see that the frequency of human exposure calls over a 3-year period is remarkably constant, with an overall increase in call volume that occurs over the summer and has as its lowest peak on Christmas Day each year. Next slide. Now we see that pesticide exposures are relatively constant over a 10-year period as well. They peak in summer and have their lowest point during winter. This is consistent throughout every year. Next slide. In this slide, we see that three different years are superimposed on the same graph over approximately a 10 to 12 month timeline. Calls about cough and cold preparations in children under age 5 years of age peak in winter months and fall off to their lowest point in the summer months. These are represented by the peaks and troughs shown on the graph. Next slide. Here is an example of data graphed about a specific clinical effect contained in the National Poisoning Data System, conjunctivitis or red eye. In this graph, we see that in general, calls about red eyes increase in the summer months and decrease during the winter months. Next slide. Here we see that calls about carbon monoxide cases by day increase consistently during the winter months. Next slide. Finally, this is another example of a graph illustrating calls about a specific clinical effect, in this case, vomiting. We see that over a 3-year period, calls about vomiting are constant, showing no predilection for time periods, seasons, or other relative time points. In other words, calls about vomiting do not really vary with time. Next slide. We have talked a lot about the structure and function of the National Poisoning Data System and the consistency of the data contained in NPDS. I would now like to talk a little bit about the toxicosurveillance methodologies used in evaluating this data. The American Association of Poison Control Centers and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention perform three general types of surveillance. Surveillance for outliers on call volume is performed hourly and at each local poison control center, as well as nationally. The threshold used to determine if there is an outlier consists of comparison with a historical baseline average and 3 standard deviations. Surveillance on the number of each of the 131 clinical effects contained in the National Poisoning Data System is also conducted on a continuous basis. In this case, the daily national cumulative total number for each clinical effect is tabulated and compared to a threshold value, which is obtained by comparison with a historical baseline average plus 2 standard deviations. Next slide. Finally, we have the capability to perform case-based surveillance, which includes organizing collections of specific clinical effects and other items in regard to specific agents. This is, however, limited to the pre-coded options contained already within the system. Case-based surveillance can also be used to track exposures to a particular product, and we'll talk more about this later. A detailed description of the early methodologies used in toxicosurveillance activities can be found in this manuscript, which was published in the Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2006. Next slide. In 2006 and 2007, the National Poisoning Data System underwent a complete rebuild. This rebuild was primarily funded through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and created enhanced capability for data management. It is incorporating GIS functions and maintains local access for each poison control center to their data. However, officials with the American Association of Poison Control Centers and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention do have access to all data for toxicosurveillance purposes. Here is the National Poisoning Data System. It is live, web-based, and is accessible online. Next slide. Routine national poisoning data system surveillance activities are primarily conducted by members of the American Association of Poison Control Centers toxicosurveillance team. When the system identifies an outlier by one of the three aforementioned surveillance methodologies, an email alert is generated to notify all members of the American Association Poison Control Center's toxicosurveillance team and other subscribers. A very partial example of the alert is below. Please note that this is a redacted photo of such an alert with identifying information about the cases and subscribers removed. Next slide. Clinical effect surveillance outlier alerts come with an attached Microsoft Excel spreadsheet illustrating the clinical effect count and the amount above the threshold value. In this case, the blue represents the area under the threshold, and the shaded area represents the amount above that threshold. More information is contained below, including the absolute case count, the historical baseline mean, and the standard deviation for that outlier. This information is coded for each outlier. The illustrations are made based on the utilization of a logarithmic format for data analysis. Next slide. I would like to emphasize that routine call volume and clinical effect monitoring is performed daily by members of the AAPCC toxicosurveillance team, although CDC scientists do have access to the data. The AAPCC toxicosurveillance team is responsible for investigation of all alerts and outliers. They typically follow up with representatives of the local poison control centers regarding outliers and monitor trends. They also can identify potential events of public health significance, and the team members themselves are located at different points and poison control centers around the country. Next slide. There is also a multidisciplinary CDC toxicosurveillance team made up of scientists with expertise in epidemiology, statistics, and medical toxicology. CDC scientists are able to conduct their own data searches for events of public health significance. They can create their own case definitions for call volume or clinical effect-based surveillance as needed for outbreaks of chemical-associated illness as they occur. CDC scientists mainly use clinical effects-based case definitions for our purposes, as we are typically conducting surveillance for cases of illness associated with a specific product. Next slide. I will briefly take you inside the National Poisoning Data System for a bit to demonstrate the utility of the system. I apologize in advance for the small print on the screenshots. Hopefully they will be readable. When you enter, you have three basic options, as you can see at the top of the screenshot. One can choose reports, toxicosurveillance activities, or utilization of the anomaly monitor function. We will talk about all three. Next slide. The reports function offers a wide variety of functions, allowing one to download different types of information from the National Poisoning Data System over a designated time period as needed. As shown in the screenshot, there are numerous ways to look at the various different types of information in the system. Next slide. The toxicosurveillance activities function allows you to build case definitions for toxicosurveillance activities, such as case-based definitions. Here, you see that we are building a specific clinical effect case-based definition, and one is able to put many different types of clarifiers on the case-based definition itself. For example, in age, which is checked above, a variety of choices are presented that can be used in building a case-based definition. One has the option to choose more than one category, or to choose one or another category, or even to exclude a particular category. As can be seen under the header at the bottom of the screenshot, Boolean expression, and is labeled AND or NOT with parentheses. In this screenshot, you can see that one can also choose a number of different clarifiers for reason for exposure, which is checked at the top of the picture. Some examples of reasons for exposure that can be selected include abuse, bite sting, contamination tampering, drug, environmental, or any of the other particular pre-coded items that exist within the system. Of course, one can also choose not to use any particular clarifiers in any or all of these particular categories. Next slide. This is an example of the clinical effect screen, in which we have the ability to include any number or combination of the listed clinical effects shown here in a case-based surveillance effort. The clinical effects button or box is checked at the top of the screen. That highlights or creates a number of options that can be chosen from the clinical effects menu. Several of the clinical effects are listed below for your view. Viewing. They include things like burns, chest pain, coma, creatinine increase, cyanosis, and many others that are part of the pre-coded clinical effects options that exist within the system. Again, one can choose from any number of these or any combination of these by using the expressions below at the bottom of the screenshot, and, or, not, and using the parentheses function. Next slide. So how are these case-based definitions used in a practical setting? Well, you may remember from earlier this year that ricin was discovered in a hotel room along with an anarchist's manual. The occupant had called 911 for the rapid onset of severe respiratory distress and was transported to a local hospital where he progressively worsened and rapidly became unresponsive and unable to answer questions. In this case, the potential risk for a chemical terrorism event was real and the motive unclear. As a result, CDC scientists set up their own case-based definition for inhalational ricin exposure. Next slide. The components of the inhalational ricin case-based surveillance definition are listed above. Note that we are limited to using the pre-coded criteria already contained in the system. In this case, the case-based definition used the following criteria. It had to have been a human. The patient had to have had dyspnea and coughing or choking, as well as respiratory arrest or pulmonary edema or x-ray findings or excess secretions or coma, and it had to have been an exposure call. Next slide. And more recently, an extraordinary high amount of selenium was found in an over-the-counter dietary supplement, which was linked to almost 200 cases of selenosis in the United States. While this was occurring, CDC scientists set up a case-based surveillance definition for selenium-associated illness. Next slide. The case definition that was used to identify cases of selenium-associated illness is listed above. It had an exposure and clinical effect component. We also worked with the American Association of Poison Control Centers to create a temporary code for this particular product so that when spies did receive a call about it, they could check this box and the information would be immediately captured via a separate mechanism. This turned out to be a much better way for this particular instance to collect case information, but required pre-identification of the implicated product, information that we fortunately had. The case-based definition for selenium-associated illness which was used included the following components. It had to have been a human, as well as an exposure call and an ingestional exposure. The patient had to have diarrhea or nausea and any number of the following symptoms listed under the third bullet of your slide. Next slide. CDC scientists can also use the National Poisoning Data System to create call volume case definitions, but do not routinely do so. As shown, we do have the ability to set a variety of limits on it, such as minimum and maximum thresholds, how long it should run, and others. Next slide. The system allows you to pick the subscribers for a specific case definition that you have built. By choosing any number of the pre-listed subscribers or adding in new subscribers to the system, once an email alert is generated for an outlier that the system has identified, it will be sent to those subscribers so that they may be notified of an aberrancy that needs to be checked. I would now like to provide an illustration of the practical utility of using the National Poisoning Data System data as a chemical outbreak surveillance system. In 2003, NPDES toxicosurveillance activities identified a call volume outlier at the Northern New England Poison Control Center. The call volume average for the hour of 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. at this poison control center was calculated to be 3.2, with a standard deviation of 3.2. That established the threshold at 12.8, which consisted of the mean plus 3 standard deviations. Now, the count for this hour was actually 17. Subsequently, an outlier alert was generated, which notified both CDC and AAPCC scientists. Next slide. When CDC and AAPCC scientists looked more closely, they discovered that on that Sunday afternoon, approximately 16 attendees of a church social fell ill with nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. Many mentioned to healthcare providers that the coffee tasted unusually bitter, but since the residents of this small New England town loved their coffee very bitter, they drank it anyway. Next slide. On day one, the first case presented to the emergency department at around 3 p.m. with nausea, vomiting, and severe GI disturbances. An astute clinician notified the infection control staff, and the first reports to the poison control center started coming in around 7:30 p.m. By 3 in the morning on the following day, the clinical toxicologist on call had been paged and informed, and later that day, the National Poisoning Data System was updated with the information. By 8 p.m. that day, arsenic had been identified in the implicated coffee and urine specimens of ill patients. These efforts facilitated rapid mobilization of antidote stockpiles and operationalization of local and regional and state agreements to share and transport antidotes for public health emergencies such as this. Next slide. Some examples of call volume outliers that have been identified by the National Poisoning Data System include methane exposures, riot control agent releases, and terrorism exercises as top off one. Next slide. So, in conclusion, the primary utility of the National Poisoning Data System in toxicosurveillance is to improve public health surveillance for chemical exposures, to identify early markers of chemical events with the objective of providing a rapid and appropriate public health response, and for CDC in particular, to track ongoing events. There are a number of limitations to toxicosurveillance activities that should be considered, including the fact that it is built along a voluntary passive reporting system, and it does have questionable utility in its ability to identify a single central event as a larger release. Next slide. There are a number of future plans for the National Poisoning Data System, including integration with BioSense, the addition of GIS capability, and the development of protocols for reviewing alerts and disseminating information. Next slide. Finally, I would like to acknowledge the members of the American Association of Poison Control Centers and CDC's toxicosurveillance teams, as well as the individual spies and directors of regional poison control centers, without whose efforts we would not be able to do these activities that we are doing. Thank you, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. To withdraw your request, you may press star 2. Once again, to ask a question, press star 1. And the first question today is from Frank Lando. You may ask your question.
Yes, hi, good afternoon. I am trying to ascertain the existence of the ATSDR CDC forward deployment team that can be utilized at scenes of either accidental or intentional chemical releases, and how this ties into the National Poison Surveillance System. And I was wondering if that team is being expanded, or do they participate often in exercises, and also what is their usual lead time if needed at the scene of an acute hazardous materials release?
Thank you for that question. Fortunately, I'm not too familiar with those teams that you are talking about, and I don't know the answers to those questions. At this time, to the best of my knowledge, those teams are not really integrated with the National Poisoning Data System. The National Poisoning Data System is more of a surveillance tool for mostly for tracking chemical-associated illness and hopefully identifying a multi-state or multi-locale outbreak of chemical-associated illness, which then could potentially trigger a number of different activities, including possible deployment of these teams. But that would depend on the specific situation and certainly would never occur without the formal request and approval and consent of state health authorities to the particular region.
And how often is the, for example, for an acute hazardous materials release, the accessibility of the poison control data monitoring system or poison control centers in general from the field? Is that a feasible option, and how often do you think it may have been used?
Well, there's definitely potential avenues for collaboration between HESIS, which is, I believe, the Hazardous Surveillance Events Release. I'm not intimately familiar with the acronym, but there is a Hazardous Event Surveillance System here referred to as HESIS. And there is definitely some interest and some activity regarding exploring how to best integrate those two surveillance systems, you know, NPDS and HESIS. But at this point, it's all very early and nothing's been done. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Once again, to ask a question, press star 1. There are no other questions, sir. Oh, pardon me. Stephen Hooser, your line is open.
Yes. This is Steve Hooser. I'm a veterinary toxicologist from Purdue University. And I was wondering if the animal information has been queried in your system?
Well, the animal information, you know, we can query it. We can look at animal exposures. We have that capability. And the American Association of the Poison Control Center staff, they have the capability of looking at animal exposures as well. Usually all of that data is at the end of the year collected and published in an annual report, which is available off their website, aapcc.org, I believe it is. So that information is available. If there is specific information in regards to animal exposures that are of particular interest that are not published in that report, typically that information can be made available through the APCC to the public for a small fee. I'm not sure exactly how much it is, but you can do that. And certainly CDC does have the capability to look at animal exposures within the system as it relates to, you know, a possible public health threat if we wanted to. But obviously, you know, there'll be even more limitations on using this data for such an event because, you know, not everybody, you know, more humans call the Human Poison Control Center database for human calls than probably veterinaries. Veterinary exposures.
Certainly. And so are there any plans to use it for toxicosurveillance, or do you have enough call volume to be able to do that?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. The idea of, you know, surveillance among animals and veterinary routes to look for, you know, to look at animals as possible sentinel events is a very popular item here. I think an item of growing interest here at CDC. So I could say that at this particular time, there's not a large amount of effort or energy right now being expended on exploring the system to that capacity. And I would say that's mainly not because of a lack of interest, but because that the system itself was just released, the new system was just released a little while ago, and we're still building it to refine human capability and human capacity and sort of maximize that potential. I think that the exploration of this system to use it in a more of a veterinary manner to look at animals as sentinel events, if that's what you're referring to, is something that we're going to be doing in the future. I just couldn't tell you when right now.
Okay, well, that answers my question. Thank you.
And the next question from Warren McDougall.
Hi, this is actually Dave Atherbin calling from the Hillsborough County Health Department in Tampa, Florida. And I had a question about who has access to this system and the analysis capabilities within this system. You know, we have one of the 61 centers here in Tampa, Florida, and I'm wondering about our ability to run analysis of this data.
That's an excellent question. One of our goals, I think, at a larger CDC level is to definitely encourage interaction and collaboration between local state health departments and poison control centers. The degree to which data sharing is even, you know, able to be done really depends on a, it's not really dependent and determined at a state level. So I would encourage you to contact your state health authorities and sort of, you know, look into that a little bit more closely. I know that Florida in particular has a really strong state health department and in terms of their relationships with their poison control centers, and they do share poison control center data, I believe, quite freely and frequently. So I think that level of collaboration and connectivity already exists in Florida, and it may be accessible to you, but you'd have to check with your state rep. You did say Florida, right?
Yes, thank you.
The next question from Patricia McLendon.
Yes, hi. I'm calling from California, and I was curious on the mean and standard deviation statistics. How often are those recalculated as the data is near real time?
Well, that's a good question. It goes back, the data itself goes back to, I believe, 2000. And the historical thresholds are based on anywhere from 3 to 5 years worth of data. They typically look at 7 days behind the day of interest and 6 days in front for anywhere from 3 to 5 years in the preceding period. Now, how often that is actually recalculated, you know, is it done on a continuous basis? That's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that. But if you were to send me an email, I could probably find out, relatively easily find out for you. And I believe COCA has a mechanism for you to do that.
Okay, thank you.
There are no other questions.
Well, I want to thank Dr. Scheer again. That was a very informative presentation, and I want to thank our listeners for joining us today. If you have any additional questions, please send an email to coca@cdc.gov. That's coca@cdc.gov. The recording of this call and the transcript will be posted to the COCA website at www.emergency.cdc.gov/COCA as they come to us. You have 1 year to obtain continuing education credits for this call. All continuing education credits for COCA conference calls are issued online through the CDC Training and Continuing Education online system. www.2a.cdc.gov/TCE online. I want to thank everybody again and have a wonderful day.
Thank you.